Tanter Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Brotherhood, When West Point Rugby Went to War, by Martin Pengelly, introduction by H.R. McMaster, narrated by Alex Mortensen. If in describing a rugby match I write, "I saw adults in short trousers fighting and throwing themselves on the ground in order to send a leather ball between a pair of wooden posts," I have summed up what I have seen. But I have intentionally missed its meaning. I am merely trying to be humorous.
Jean-Paul Sartre.
I'm afraid of Americans. David Bowie. Preface. Rugby union is a 15-a-side ball-handling contact sport that arose from the schools of England in the mid-1800s. Its great stadiums are in London, Cardiff, and Edinburgh, in Dublin and in Paris, in Johannesburg, Auckland, and Sydney. It is played with passion in Argentina, Samoa, and Japan, in Fiji, Uruguay, and Kenya, in Romania, Russia, and Georgia. It is generally held to have come to North America in 1874, when Harvard played McGill. Thanks to Hooped Cotton Shirts by Ralph Lauren, or that Clint Eastwood movie about Nelson Mandela and the World Cup, or even the episode of Friends where Ross tries to impress a British girlfriend, most Americans know what rugby is. But in the American mind, rugby lost out to football long ago. Still, American rugby is a flourishing subculture, passionate and resilient. Most Americans who pick up the game pick it up at college. Presidents Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Joe Biden did so. So did senators like Ted Kennedy and Chris Murphy, cabinet secretaries like James Baker and Gina Raimondo, and captains of business like Mark Cuban. Kurt Vonnegut didn't play rugby, but he did write about it. It was May 1941, and he was reporting for the Cornell Daily Sun. The college rugby club, he wrote, "needs more players and more student support to survive. Is there anyone in this school that would like to play a damned good game faster than football and harder than soccer?" Any reasonably arch observer of American rugby and its struggles over the next 80 years might be tempted to add, "so it goes." This is a book about American rugby. But if they want to listen to this book, as Vonnegut wrote, "a person doesn't have to speak with an English accent or know a blessed thing about the game. It is a book about the sporting spirit, the thrill of the chase and the tackle. I do happen to speak with an English accent, and this book could not exist if I had not played rugby through my childhood and youth, then spent large parts of my adult life writing about it for money. I married an American and moved to New York. The game stayed with me." This is also a book about something Kurt Vonnegut, who wrote Slaughterhouse-Five, knew rather more about: the U.S. Army. This book tells the stories of 15 young men who went to West Point before 9/11 and were senior cadets that dreadful day and officers in the wars that followed. Because those 15 young men graduated in 2002 and served from 2003, this is a book largely about the invasion of Iraq, and the war there rather than the one in Afghanistan. Many of the West Point rugby brothers went to Afghanistan, but in the years covered by this book, those who saw combat did so in Iraq. While this book touches on many aspects of the Iraq War, it is not about why America chose to take Baghdad, how the case for war unraveled, how sectarian conflict bloomed, how nearly 4,600 U.S. troops were killed, how almost 32,000 were wounded, and how hundreds of thousands of Iraqis were maimed or killed. This is a book about one group of young American men who found rugby together, became soldiers together, and served their country, right or wrong. It is a book about how I set out to learn what happened to them when they went to war. To reach for Shakespeare, as the cadets did, it is a book about a band of brothers. Martin Pengelly. Introduction. This is a story of a rugby team. Martin Pengelly played lock forward in London in 2002 against those to whom he is about to introduce you: Brotherhood, is a brilliant group biography of the individual cadets who played against Pengelly's Rosslyn Park Football Club. But it is also much more. Listeners will not only learn about the sport for which the author and I share great affinity, they will find in this book an abundance of what seems scarce in society today, exemplars of comradeship and the willingness to sacrifice for one another and one's fellow citizens. The brothers of West Point's 2002 rugby team came from diverse backgrounds and grew into a team bound together by common purpose, mutual trust, and affection. They cared not from whence their teammates came, nor for any identity categories into which they might fit. They earned respect from one another based on their character and athletic prowess. Their stories shed light on something that few Americans understand, an ethos grounded in honor, courage, and loyalty that binds warriors to one another. The brothers internalized this ethos at West Point, exhibited it on the rugby pitch, and carried it with them onto battlefields abroad. In contrast to popular culture's tendency to cheapen and coarsen the warrior's ethos, Pengelly reveals the sense of honor that motivates young men and women to lead soldiers in our army. Colonel Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, an erstwhile professor of languages and rhetoric at Bowdoin College, who, on July 2, 1863, led the soldiers of the 20th Maine Infantry Regiment in a bold bayonet charge that blunted a Confederate attack at the Battle of Gettysburg, observed that in battle, the instinct to seek safety is overcome by the instinct of honor. Good rugby teams play tough, and good army units fight hard, in part because teammates expect one another to display virtue and avoid dishonor. A sense of honor is a crucial component of effectiveness. It also underpins the expectation that rugby players behave like gentlemen on the pitch, as well as the moral and ethical standards that make war less inhumane. The cadet ruggers were commissioned as officers in the United States Army 8 months after the most devastating and deadliest terrorist attack in history took the lives of nearly 3,000 of their fellow citizens. They selected army combat branches and went to war. They built teams and led them in battle. They and their soldiers fought with distinction in dangerous places. Listeners might be tempted to contrast the leadership these young men displayed so soon after graduation with the safetyism that pervades so many academic institutions today. There are no safe spaces to which one might retreat on rugby pitches or on battlefields overseas. Thankfully, our nation still has stoic warriors who are willing to face dangers much greater than those one confronts in even the fiercest rugby mall. At West Point, the brothers learned from military history and from rugby that the need to develop cohesive, confident teams to withstand the test of battle is timeless. Cohesion is essential for combat effectiveness and resilience. Good combat units take on the quality of family, in which its members have deep affection for their brothers and sisters in arms. As John Keegan observed in The Face of Battle, his classic 1976 study of combat in the same geographic area across five centuries, from Agincourt, 1415, to Waterloo, 1815, to the Somme, 1916. What battles have in common is human, the behavior of men struggling to reconcile their instinct for self-preservation, their sense of honor, and the achievement of some aim over which other men are ready to kill them. He observed that the study of battle is always a study of solidarity, and usually also of disintegration, for it is toward the disintegration of human groups that battle is directed. The warrior ethos is foundational to maintaining the cohesion of one's own human group and generating the fortitude and combat prowess necessary to disintegrate the enemies. Cohesive rugby and army teams have trust and confidence in their leaders. Pengelly tells us how young leaders put mission accomplishment and the survival and well-being of those they led before their own well-being and thereby inspired soldiers to act in ways contrary to the natural drive of self-preservation. Confidence and unit cohesion are necessary ingredients for courage because they form a psychological and emotional bulwark against fear. Fear is debilitating in rugby and in battle because it can lead to hesitation and allow the other side to gain the initiative. Sacrifice is part of this story. These young men face hardships and traumas associated with their service, including physical adversity, separation from family, physical wounds, and most difficult of all, the loss of friends in battle. Listeners will get to know men who died far too young, and those who gave what President Abraham Lincoln described in the Gettysburg Address as the last full measure of devotion. Pengelly tells us how the families of the fallen and their teammates grieve their loss and honor their memory. He also helps us understand how West Point and the United States Army are living historical communities in which younger generations look to earlier generations for inspiration and to understand better their calling as soldiers. Consider the lyrics of the Corps, a poetic hymn written around 1902 by West Point Chaplain Bishop H.S. Shipman, which every cadet must memorize. We sons of today, we salute you. You sons of an earlier day, we follow close order behind you where you have pointed the way. The long gray line of us stretches through the years of a century told, and the last man feels to his marrow the grip of your far-off hold. At West Point, monuments and memorials appear at every turn to remind future officers about the legacy of courage and honor that they have inherited from those who went before them. Pengelly tells us how teammates visited the beaches of Normandy and felt a visceral connection to those who summoned the medal to assault Nazi defensive fortifications on June 6, 1944. The best army leaders draw strength from the past as they mold future generations through their example and their mentorship. You will hear about one of those leaders, Colonel Mike Mahan, who served as assistant and then head coach for West Point rugby across more than three decades and remained connected to Army rugby teams even after he moved to California. Commissioned during the Vietnam War, Mahan witnessed many changes at West Point and in the Army. But he was a source of one of the greatest continuities in the profession of arms, the opportunity to develop the next generations of leaders. Mahan epitomized the positive leader whom no one wanted to let down. He and his fellow coaches motivated and inspired my teammates and me in the early 1980s. Pengelly's focus here in brotherhood is the class of 2002, but the comradeship and commitment to one another he writes about evoked memories of my experience as an Army rugby player. I still count among my closest and most trusted friends the men I met when I first stepped onto a rugby pitch more than four decades ago. It is my hope that young men and women who listen to this book will be inspired to serve based on the story of these brothers, who bore hardships and made sacrifices, but also reaped rewards associated with fulfilling their duty to their country, to their soldiers, and to one another. H.R. McMaster, USMA, Class of 1984, Stanford, California. The team. West Point Rugby 2002. A rugby team consists of 15 players, 8 forwards wearing jerseys numbered 1 through 8, and 7 backs numbered 9 through 15. Jared Adams, position wing, final rank and posting, Lieutenant Colonel, 164th Theater Airfield Operations Group. Matt Blind, position fullback, team captain, final rank and posting, Captain, 3rd Battalion, 21st Infantry Regiment, 1st Striker Brigade, 25th Infantry Division. Pete Chacon, position, wing, final rank and posting, Captain, 3rd Battalion, 187th Infantry Brigade, 101st Infantry Division, Air Assault. Joe Emai, position, center, final rank, 2nd Lieutenant, Field Artillery. Mo Green, position, fly half, final rank and posting, Colonel, Professor of Military Science, Western Kentucky University, ROTC. James Gerbitz, position, hooker, final rank and posting, Captain, 26th Forward, Support Battalion, 2nd Brigade, 3rd Infantry Division. Jeremiah Hurley, position, prop, final rank and posting, Lieutenant Colonel P., Deputy Chief Technology Officer and Director of Innovation, Joint Special Operations Command. Andy Klutman, position, prop, final rank and posting, Captain, 165th Infantry Brigade, United States Army Training and Doctrine Command. Dave Little, position, number 8, final rank and posting, Major Executive Officer, Missile Defense Agency. Brian McCoy, position, flanker, Team Vice Captain, final rank and posting, Captain, 5th Battalion, 158th Aviation Regiment, and 8th Army Aviation Staff. Zach Miller, position, flanker, final rank, 2nd Lieutenant Infantry. Clint O'Leernick, position, center, final rank and posting, Major, 1st Battalion, 327th Infantry Regiment, 1st Brigade Combat Team, 101st Airborne Division, Air Assault. Brian Phillips, position, lock, final rank and posting, Captain, 1st Battalion, 1st Air Defense Artillery Regiment, Patriot, 69th ADA Brigade. Scott Radcliffe, position, back row, final rank and posting, Captain, speechwriter to the Multinational Corps, Iraq Commander. Nick Vibachinsky, position, lock, final rank and posting, Lieutenant, 3rd Battalion, 43rd Air Defense Artillery Regiment, Patriot, 11th ADA Brigade. Mike Mahan, position, coach, final rank and posting, Lieutenant Colonel, Associate Professor of Chemistry, West Point. Shitsucker. Iraq is home to 19 species of scorpion, some among the deadliest in the world. There is Androctonus crassicata, the man-killer. There is Lirius quinquestriatus, the death stalker. Scorpions stir primal fear. Before the U.S. invasion of Iraq in March 2003, the CIA trained Iraqis to foment rebellion, conduct sabotage, and help target buildings and individuals. Such paramilitary groups were involved in abuse and torture. They called themselves the Scorpions. Hammam al-Alil is a small town in northern Iraq, 40 kilometers south of Mosul. In November 2004, American soldiers there took soda bottles and cut off each of the ends. Then they put a scorpion in one end and a mouse in the other and made bets on the fight. Their officers winced a little, but there wasn't much real fighting to do. Apart from the odd burst of mortar fire, Hammam al-Alil was quiet. 321 Infantry, part of the 2nd Striker Brigade, had been in country a month. In their redoubt, a concrete office block, fully wired, four corners, four machine guns, the soldiers marked time. There was an insurgent cell in town, hence the mortars, but there were not enough troops to go find them. There were patrols, but mostly the redoubt held everyone. It was close and dull and hot. Matt Blind was 2 years out of West Point, where he had captained the rugby team. Now he was a green lieutenant watching his men bet on the Scorpions. His 2 years since graduation had been filled with training, driving and flying to, up from Fort Benning, Georgia, to his home in rural Ohio, in the farm country around Akron, to Athens, to see Aaron, his girlfriend who became his wife. Back to Georgia, assignments. Florida, California, Louisiana. On his first day at Fort Lewis in Washington State, he was given his platoon. The commander, Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Heineman, was a rugby player, coach of the Tacoma Nomads, a local team of last chancers. Heineman gave Blind 46 soldiers and some strikers, eight-wheeled troop carriers coming in to replace vulnerable Humvees. At West Point, Blind had led 15 men from fullback, a general behind the lines. 2 years later, with his 46 men in Hammam al-Alil, he was still in the backfield, wondering where the action would be. In the soda bottles, the mice put up a good show. Their paws were coated with glue from improvised traps, But all the scorpions could do was skitter back and forth, arching their tails, making hopeful strikes. Blind didn't encourage his men in the grisly pursuit, but he didn't discourage them either. Bored soldiers must fill time. Thousands of years before, in the nearby city of Hatra, Roman legionaries probably did similar, using earthenware pots. Maybe they scooped up the scorpions their besiegers catapulted into the city. In late 2004, the insurgents of Imam al-Alil weren't trying that. If they had, the soldiers might have run out of mice. The town stayed quiet. Later, when all of Iraq was in flames, the U.S. Army established a forward operating base in Imam al-Alil.
They called it Fob Scorpion.
One fine spring day years later, I went to Hingham, Massachusetts, a couple of towns down the south shore from Boston on the way to the Cape. At the Black Rock Country Club, where Bill Belichick, coach of the New England Patriots, has a house on a fairway, the lush greens and white sand bunkers were quiet. Matt Blind strode into the bar, fit mid-30s, neatly pressed in golfing gear and West Point polo shirt, aviator shades pushed back over short blonde hair, hand out, smiling. He was on vacation from his investments job in Boston and had driven his pickup from Scituate, where he lived, then with Aaron and their three young boys. Out on the balcony after lunch, Blind stretched back in his chair. He straightened his shades and thought back to Imam al-Alil, the dust, the scorpions, the boredom, the hurry up and wait. As we spoke, Mosul and its surroundings were occupied by Islamic State, the brutal militant group which spawned in the chaos of Iraq and Syria after the American invasion, dislodging al-Qaeda as U.S. enemy number one. Blind had been home 11 years, out of the army for 9. U.S. troops were still in Iraq. They would soon be in Syria. Blind had fought in a vicious, many-sided war. It had not ended. Worse, it had mutated.
He thought back to October 2004, when he led patrols in a town that was nothing next to what came later in Mosul.
But there was foreboding. Imam al-Alil was a goofy place, he said, because you could tell that the people didn't want us. When you went through a neighborhood that wasn't supportive of Americans, you could tell. You could tell by the way the kids reacted. Kids react the way their parents do.
My kids like the same sports teams I like.
They like the same restaurants I like. In Iraq, most neighborhoods we'd go through, the kids would be cheering and waving, and the parents would wave too, and we'd hand out candy and soccer balls and footballs. Down there, in Imam al-Alil, it wasn't like that. You'd drive through and people would turn their heads away. They'd try to get their kids out of the street. It's not that they were afraid of us. It was probably a function of there being a fairly active insurgent cell in town. But we didn't have the firepower or intelligence to go after that, so we basically just stayed put. After a while, the scorpions and mice began to lose their pull. There was another way to pass the time. There was no running water or facilities, so it was like 3 weeks without a shower, a running faucet, a toilet, or anything like that. So we had some porta-potties delivered, and one of the biggest things to do was we'd call the Iraqi guy who came to suck the porta-potties, the shit-sucker. That was the activity of the day, when the shit-sucker would come up to the gate, and I'd be out there negotiating with him. I'll pay you $75 to go suck the shitters. West Point's motto is duty, honor, country. It was his duty, Blind supposed, to get the shit sucker to the lowest possible price. His duty to his country. There wasn't much honor in it, but it was one way to serve the American taxpayer. Save some dollars on the shit sucker as Iraq went to shit. Some of the soldiers started placing bets on how low the shit-sucker would go. I actually took that post over from Ryan Sutherland, who was a lieutenant in the 1st Striker Brigade and a good friend of mine at West Point. He and I did the whole transition together, and he couldn't have called it more accurately. The guys are going to be bored. You've got to keep their minds off bad stuff, and you just kind of got to get through it. We were down there 3 weeks, and that was our first 3 weeks in country. We thought, we got to do this for a year? Watch scorpions and mice fight each other? Negotiate with the shit sucker, really? But then we got the call that we were going to abandon the Hammam al-Alil outpost the last few days in October. And then we came up to Mosul, and shit kind of blew up. For 18 months or so after the invasion in March 2003, Mosul was relatively quiet. The 101st Airborne occupied it, and its commander, Major General David Petraeus, kept the peace with Sunni tribes and the Kurds to the north. But in October 2004, serious fighting broke out in Fallujah, and a battalion of the 25th Infantry Division, a successor to the 101st in Mosul, moved south to join in. As it did so, insurgents moved back up to Mosul. On November 8, 2004, U.S. and Iraqi forces were attacked with small arms, machine guns, and mortars. Americans were injured. Strikers hit roadside bombs. Matt Blind and his men went to find the enemy. At the Hingham Golf Course, Blind took a sip of his beer. The battalion commander just said, "Go out and turn over every stone that you possibly can. Uncover everything. Knock down as many doors as you possibly can, and let's draw a line in the sand." At first, the Americans worked with caution. Blind was in one striker, his platoon sergeant was in another, and they sat at a Y-shaped intersection in a densely populated area. There was some mortar fire, some small arms fire, ineffective, from rooftops or behind buildings. Blind took a look out of the hatch of his striker, then consulted the systems within. This was it. Contact. In training, instructors posited situations and demanded action. There was no live fire. Nobody was trying to kill you. Rugby, if Blind had thought about it, posited immediate changing circumstances, situations that demanded decisive response. If you didn't go in hard, you could get hurt. But not too badly, most of the time. I was on the radio talking to my platoon sergeant, saying, "You know, we've got to go in there. We're sitting there in all this fire. We're a sitting duck. We got to go in there." And Sergeant Sanchez says, "Yeah, I think that's the right move." So I say, "Okay, well, what do we do now?" Blind laughed. I remember telling Sergeant Sanchez, "Well, I guess I'm the platoon leader. I'll move first." And so he moved. After 300 yards, he told his driver to stop. Sanchez followed, then stopped 50 yards further on. It was a bounding overwatch, a move off the training grounds of Yakima out in the desert in Washington State. On the balcony in Hingham, Blind made chops at the air by his face, describing shorter and shorter bounds. In Mosul, gunners fired MK-19's air-cooled 40-millimeter machine guns that fire armor-piercing grenades. It was mostly to keep the enemy's head down, short bursts of unfocused fire. Blind rode low in his seat, eyes peeking over the top of the hatch. "We were doing these bounds that were like 50 yards at a time," he said, "like inching forward." He laughed. "So we got into where we thought the fire was coming from, and this probably took, you know, 3 or 4 minutes, but we needed to go into this neighborhood, and the streets were very narrow. I took a left-hand turn, and there was a guy sitting in the middle of the street with an RPG, and he fired the RPG." The man aimed right at Blind's striker. He missed. The heat of the rocket scorched Blind's helmet, but the rocket-propelled grenade roared past and exploded behind him. Blind blinked. The man disappeared. And then we started firing. It was just kind of chaos after that. I don't remember a whole lot. We ended up going through that neighborhood a little bit and then back to the original position. And then a car pulled up. A guy got out and started to pull something out of the trunk. So we went up and engaged. There were two guys there. We lit up the car with MK-19 and the guys were still there. And MK-19 will set a car up, set it on fire, lift it up off the ground.
and the guys were still there.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?